It's my pleasure to introduce to you Andrew Tenapier Lundeen. I met Andrew last summer when Andrew, as a library student at the University of Illinois, visited me in Special Collections and asked if he could do an internship in Special Collections. After speaking with Andrew for just a few minutes, I was delighted to accept his request, and I charged him with the responsibility of establishing a provenance program in Special Collections. The results of his work is what you will see today. I'm pleased that they were so successful that after the internship was finished, Andrew, because he lives in Eaton Rapids, was able to come and visit Special Collections on a weekly basis to continue the project. I won't go into all the importance of provenance, what provenance is, what it means for Special Collections, because I will let Andrew do that for himself. So please welcome Andrew Tenapier Lundeen.
Thank you. As Peter said, my name is Andrew Lundeen, and I'm currently a graduate student at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, where I'm finishing up a master's in library and information science. I have I see a lot of Illinois fans here, or alumni in the audience, that's good. I received a certification in Special Collections from the Midwest Book and Manuscript Studies program at Illinois last year, and I'm also currently pursuing a master's specialization in digital data curation. As Peter said, although I'm a student at Illinois, I actually live locally, just south of the Lansing area, and I'm taking classes at Illinois mostly through their fantastic distance ed program. For the past 9 months or so, I've been here first as an intern and then working part-time, spearheading the Special Collections Provenance Project, which is what I'm here to talk to you today about. I plan to talk for 30 or 40 minutes or so, give or take, after which there will be a Q&A session. So if you do have any questions, please try and hold them until then. Before we get started, I just want to draw your attention to these fantastic examples that we have up here on the table. After the Q&A session is done, if you want to come up, take a closer look at these, feel free. We'll stick around. Peter and I will stick around. We can talk a little bit more about these, explain what's going on here. Some of these books I'm also going to use as examples in the talk today. Other books I'm going to be featuring are currently in an exhibit case downstairs, the one outside the Writing Center on the first floor. You may have seen it already. If you haven't, I encourage you to stop by and take a look. There's some interesting things in there. Let's see, without any further ado, I guess let's get started. So, as I said, I'm here to talk about the Provenance Project. So it would probably be helpful if I went ahead and explained what provenance is in the context of rare books. Now, I know that most of you are library professionals and you probably already know what provenance means, or at least are familiar with it in some sense, but different fields use the term in slightly different ways. At its most basic, provenance simply refers to where something is from, who created it, and when. But when we use the term here at Special Collections, we mean something a little more. We mean not only where something is from, but also where it's been, its entire life story, if you will. So with that in mind, I'd like to present to you the following definition of provenance for the context of this talk. Provenance refers to the chain of custody of an object, the history of its ownership from its origin to the present day. Imagine, if you will, let's say a timeline or a chain of custody. For most of our rare books, the first link in that chain is obvious. It's the publication info for the book, where it was printed, who printed it, and when. Now, for many of our manuscripts, that can be harder to determine, but most of the things we're looking at in the Provenance Project are early printed books, and usually that's pretty easy information to find. It's usually right in the front of the book. The link on the opposite end of the chain should also be pretty obvious. Who can tell me what that would be? Right. That's who owns the book today. It's us here at MSU in the present day. Usually, although not always, there is at least one other link on the chain that we can know right off the bat. Who can guess what that would be? Right, exactly. It's the link right before us on the ownership history. It's where we acquired the item. Now I say we usually know that and not always because sometimes we don't have detailed acquisition records, particularly for old books or books that we acquired before Special Collections was even really a separate entity. But usually we can assume that we can find something out about where we acquired it pretty easily. And then in an ideal world, we would be able to fill in every other link on the chain and have a complete ownership history of any given item. I say an ideal world because that's really just sort of a fantasy for most of the books in our collection. But as I hope to show today, even if we can't establish a complete ownership history of an item, studying provenance and looking at the provenance evidence in books can still be rewarding. So, what types of evidence do we look at? How does provenance manifest itself in rare books? Well, some of the types of evidence that we look at include ownership inscriptions, presentation inscriptions, book plates. And this book plate, by the way, you may notice is from one of the Earls of Sandwich, the famous namesake of what many of you are probably eating for lunch today. All of these examples, by the way, all of the images from the presentation today, with one exception, which I'll get to shortly, are from books here that we have in our collections. They're downstairs in special collections in the vault in most cases, and you can come by and see them anytime. Many are featured here. Again, many are featured downstairs in the exhibit case. We also look at marginalia, marginal notes, and other annotations. That book is sitting right up here. Things inserted loosely into a book or pasted in, like old newspaper articles. Unique or special bindings. Binding waste, which is, of course, scraps of older books or manuscripts that are used to reinforce the binding of a later book, and other evidence of how a book is put together, and a whole lot more. There's a lot of evidence that we look at here, too much to show you today, and these represent just a small percentage of the total interesting items that we've looked at over the course of this provenance project. Okay, but why bother? Why do we study rare book provenance at all? Why is it important? Well, there are a few reasons. One reason is authentication. A detailed record of ownership can show, for example, that a rare old book really is as rare or as old as it claims to be. Authentication can also be useful when one piece of provenance evidence can help us authenticate another, particularly if that other is in the form of a signature or an autograph from a famous historical figure. You know, when I was originally putting this talk together and preparing for this presentation, I wasn't really going to mention authentication, or at least I wasn't going to spend very much time on it. There are a couple of reasons for that. One is it's really used a lot more. Provenance is used a lot more for this purpose in the art world rather than the rare book world. And because of that, it can be hard to find really good examples of how rare book provenance can be used for this purpose. But as luck would have it, there's been a news story floating around for the past few days. It's been sort of setting social media on fire. Many of you may have heard about it. These two rare book dealers in New York claim to have found a 16th century dictionary that was annotated by Shakespeare. They claim that the evidence, and there are lots of marginalia and lots of notes in the book, they claim that the evidence is strong that this copy was actually owned and used and annotated by William Shakespeare. I think I have there's the title page of the book, by the way, which is being affectionately referred to as Shakespeare's Beehive. I'm not going to get into all of the details of this story, but suffice it to say that academics have been skeptical, to say the least. Many have basically dismissed the claims outright, calling them ludicrous. Others are saying, okay, yeah, the book might be Shakespeare's, but we're not convinced. Your burden of proof is tremendously high here, so convince us. Well, what would it take to convince them? What sort of research would need to be done on this book and on these notes to be able to prove or disprove that they were Shakespeare's? Well, a few days ago, the Folger Shakespeare Library put out this blog article that lays out exactly that. They talk about the kind of research that would need to be done in this item, research that includes paleography, studying the handwriting of the notes, comparing it to known examples of Shakespeare's hand and to other contemporary annotations, and marginalia. Now, the font is a little small here, but this section is important, so I'm going to go ahead and read what they say. The authors say, "How typical or unique are the annotators' use of slashes, circles, trefoils, and underlinings? Is the cross-referencing, translation, and supplementation suggestive of revision for a later edition, or of creating a treasury of words for personal use?" Which is what the booksellers claim Shakespeare was using the dictionary for. "How do the annotations compare to those of well-known Elizabethan annotators such as John Dee, whose marginalia is the subject of a major study by Bill Sherman, or Gabriel Harvey, whose marginalia has also been the study of book-length studies and critical inquiry?" So this is something that's happening right now. It's in the news right now. It demonstrates how valuable provenance research can be, how valuable it is to have a robust database of provenance evidence. Finding out whether or not these notes are authentic, or I should say authentically Shakespeare's, could be the difference between this book being worth $5,000, which I think is about what the booksellers paid for it themselves, or $5 million, which, by the way, is a conservative estimate. Some people have said that if the notes actually are proven to be Shakespeare's, it could be worth tens of millions of dollars. It's essentially priceless at that point. And it's not just about money. You know, lest I appear shallow, think about the scholarly implications of this too. Any scholar of Shakespeare, of history, of English would be thrilled to have a book, a cheat sheet that Shakespeare used for building his vocabulary. Any library that had this item, if they weren't already on the map, man, they'd be set at this point. So this example is a really good illustration of another use of provenance, not just authentication, but adding value to a work, monetary or scholarly value, through its association with a famous historical figure or event. And we have some examples of this, by the way, this sort of thing, right here at MSU. We don't have examples that are we haven't found, I should say, examples quite as exciting as this possible Shakespeare thing yet. Yet, we're still looking. But we do have some examples that are real examples. These are things that are proven, that are true, that we have in our collection, in our hands, again, downstairs in the vault. For example, we have a first edition of The Great Gatsby by F. Scott Fitzgerald. This is one of the items that is featured in our exhibit case downstairs. In that Great Gatsby, on one of the front fly leaves, is this note, a note from the author. And it says, "For Charles T. Scott, Gatsby was never quite real to me. His original served for a good enough exterior until about the middle of the book he grew thin and I began to fill him with my own emotional life. So he's synthetic, and that's one of the flaws in this book." And then he signs it at the bottom there. Now, some of you, as librarians or as friends of the library, may be cringing to see somebody writing in a book, even if it is the author. But as I hope to show today, studying these marks in books can be extremely rewarding for historians or scholars of books and writing and reading and that sort of thing. This example is not only a signature, an autograph from a famous author, one of the most influential authors of the 20th century, it's a signature attached to a personalized presentation inscription. But not only is it a personalized presentation inscription, it's a personalized presentation inscription that actually reveals something about the author and about his creative process in writing the novel. It has some literary weight to it, as short as it is. Not only does this inscription increase the monetary value of the book through association, you can also see how it could increase potentially the scholarly value as well. And this is unique. You know, the thing about provenance evidence is that it's unique, and it makes every single copy of a book potentially unique. This book with this inscription in it, we have the only copy. It's not anywhere else. If you want to see it, you have to come here and you have to look at this page. And that's one of the other great things about provenance. Here's another example of provenance providing some association value. This book is also featured downstairs, by the way, so if you've seen it already, just bear with me. It may not look like much. This binding, by the way, isn't even vellum. It's just a cheap paper basically a cheap paperback binding, the 18th century equivalent of that. And it's a minor, it's a reprint even of a minor botanical work that doesn't really have very much importance, even for the history of botany. It's, you know, has some minor importance. Our catalog entry for the work doesn't reveal much more. It just has the basic bibliographic information. But, you know, what they say, you can't judge a book by its cover. You look inside the book, and there are a few interesting things, including this inscription. Now, I want to make a disclaimer here. It's perfectly understandable that this inscription was not noted in the catalog record. We have a lot of old books here, and I would say that most of them have some writing in them. They've been marked up at some point in their history. This inscription doesn't really look a whole lot different than a lot of other inscriptions that we have. It doesn't look all that notable. It's not really feasible to transcribe or to mention every single mark in books that we have. But you do a little research on this, and it turns out that it is a presentation inscription. Presentation inscription from this guy to this guy. And this, by the way, this is not a 2 here. This is a J-O colon, which is a common early abbreviation for Johannes or Johann. So we have Johannes Gabriel, with the date of Latin ending here, because this whole thing has been Latinized. Johannes Gabriel Doppelmayr. Okay. Viro sapientissimo. Now that in Latin means the wisest man. And when I saw that, I said, okay, wait a minute. Who is this guy that he's being addressed as the wisest man? Well, if you Google him, you'll find that he actually has a Wikipedia page. So he must be famous, right? It turns out that he is a late 17th, early 18th century scientist and astronomer and mathematician who lived in Nuremberg. And sure enough, by the way, if you go back, you can see here, Nuremberg in the Latin. So, now this guy never achieved the fame of his contemporaries, Isaac Newton, rough contemporaries, Isaac Newton or Edmund Halley, after whom Halley's Comet is named, but he's still an important figure in the history of science and in the history of astronomy. He even, and I just love this, he even has a crater on the moon named after him. And this was his book. This was his book. We have it here at MSU. Not a book that he wrote, but a book that was in his personal library. Again, it's unique. So these last two examples demonstrate another aspect of, or touch on another aspect of provenance and why it's important, not only for authentication and association value, but also because when looking at the marks in books, we can learn not only about the books themselves, we can often learn a great deal about the world outside of these books. We can learn about the history of the book trade. We can learn about the habits of early readers, the habits of early scholars often, and other things that are of interest to historians. Going back to these two examples again, as we saw in the Fitzgerald inscription, not only can we learn that this book was presented at one point in time by Fitzgerald to this guy, Charles Scott, we can also learn something about the author and about his writing process, about the novel. This Doppelmayr inscription lets us learn something, albeit small, about the man. We can learn, for one, that he had this book in his collection. We can also learn that his friends and colleagues thought highly enough of him to address him as the wisest man. But we have other examples, better examples of this sort of thing. These are images of the inside covers, the paste-down end papers, from an 18th century work, a medical text. And as you can see, there's a lot going on here. I've enhanced the quality of these a little bit in Photoshop. They're still very hard to read. It's in pencil. But if you can see, here on the right, for example, in the middle of the page, there is a good cure for diarrhea or cholera. Sorry for, you know, I know this is a lunchtime talk, but this sort of thing is actually really common. We see a lot of these handwritten remedies and recipes written into medical texts and early cookbooks, too. Cookbooks were often used to record medical treatments and medical remedies as well, and people, a lot of times, doctors or no, wrote their own versions to supplement the text. But there's other stuff going on here, too. So below this remedy, you can see there are a couple of, I don't know if you can make them out, but there are a couple of rhyming verses here, little limericks almost. And because they're a little hard to read, I'm going to go ahead and read them for you. The first one there in the middle. Farewell shoes that's got no soles on. Farewell fires that's got no coals on. Farewell cupboards that are empty. Farewell landlords, for you have plenty. And then the one on the bottom. Since man to man is so unjust, I do not know what man to trust. I have trusted many to my sorrow. Pay me today, and I will trust tomorrow. And these are just great. I just love these. And these are also surprisingly common, not these specific verses, but people often wrote poems in their books. They wrote prayers in their books. They used their books as journals, as personal diaries. They would write reminders to themselves and to their friends in their books that they kept or lent. This was, of course, an era before smartphones. They would occasionally write things like grocery lists in their books. I don't know if I'd want to carry a big, thick hardback with me shopping, but again, no smartphones, so what are you going to do? The uses that people had for their books, their early books, are almost endless. One of the most common ways that people would mark their books is, of course, claiming it as theirs, writing their name in a book, marking it for ownership. But often they would do more than just write their name or write the date in a book. They would occasionally pen these rhyming ownership inscriptions, too. This is another fairly surprisingly common practice from the 16th century all the way to the 20th. And we have a couple of examples of that here. Starting at the top here on the left, this says, if thou art borrowed by a friend, right welcome shall he be, to read, to copy, not to lend, but to return to me. And then in the middle, this is a little harder to read, but not that imported knowledge doth diminish learning's store, but books that I have often lent return to me no more. And then he breaks the rhyme here at the bottom. Read slowly, pause frequently, think seriously, keep clean, return duly, and the corners not turned down. This is one of my favorites. I saw that and I immediately wanted to go home and write this in all of my books, but I had to restrain myself. So, these are just some of the examples of these sort of rhyming verses and the sort of uses that people had for their books. And as I said, this rhyming ownership inscription thing is actually pretty common. Many of these types of things are formulaic. You start collecting enough data, you start looking at other provenance databases out there, and you can see patterns emerge. You can see that some of these are used with some modification, a couple of words changed out here or there by other people at other points in time in other places. Here, there's a couple of more that I have examples of. This one is, again, this is in the case downstairs. You may have seen it. This is another rhyming ownership inscription. It says, whose book I am, if you would know, in letters bright, I will you show. The first is T, a letter bright. The next is S in all men's sight. If you should chance to look amiss, see here beneath. And there it is. And there it is. Thomas Sunderland. This is another rhyming sort of inscription I'm about to show you. This one is very formulaic. You see this popping up all over the place throughout history, really. This one says, Edward Swallow is my name, and England is my nation, and heaven is my habitation. Now that may be hard to read. The quality is not great. First of all, I apologize, it's a small section of a small book. But the handwriting is also not very good, and it's crammed in there a little bit. Some of those letters, some of those words are a little difficult to make out. But this is one of the values of having a big database of provenance data to look at. It allows us to make educated guesses about some of these things, which otherwise that might be just arcane to us. We wouldn't know what that says. What is this word here, for example, H maybe? But we see that a lot. We see it popping up again and again, and we can piece it together from studying the handwriting and also just studying other examples that we have. But you did not have to own a book to write a rhyming inscription in it. This example is great. William Richards, not owner of this book, but his name in it you'll find if right you look. And sure enough, there on the right is a very stylized, almost unreadable signature. We know it's his, William Richards, because he practices his signature in the back of the book as well. And then again, it's a very stylized William, W.M. almost, Richards. This book, by the way, that William Richards did not own, is a grammar book for students, basically a textbook in orthography and writing. My wife is a high school teacher down in Springport. And let me tell you, students today are still doing this sort of thing. They're doodling in their textbooks, they're writing their names in their books, and they have been for hundreds of years. Looking at this provenance evidence is great because it can teach you new surprising things. You can learn things that aren't often enough included in the history books. You can learn about how people of the past were different from you, but you also learn occasionally that they were similar in surprising ways. People are still doing this sort of thing. People still write their names in their books. And these books that we're looking at, these old books, these are books that real people used and read and loved often. A great example of just how much people cared about their books is the lengths that they would go to not only claim them as their own, but to add value to the books for them or for their friends when they lent them out. Most early books, most early printed books, did not come with printed indexes. And so book owners would often add their own handwritten indexes. These are a couple of examples here. This one on the right, by the way, is short. It's just basically this page, and it's a small book. We have it up here. This one on the left, however, is, first of all, it's a big book. It's this gigantic one up here. It's about that big. And this this index goes on for a couple of pages, a few pages. Notice also that both of these are alphabetized. Imagine the amount of work that would have to go into something like this. I mean, you'd have to be so familiar with the text, not only to be able to write an index of its contents, but also to organize it, to alphabetize it, presumably on the first try, since these are written in the books themselves on the paste downs and the fly leaves. It shows how much the users cared about their books. It also reveals something about them. It shows, for example, what they thought was important in the text. No index is ever exhaustive. There are decisions that have to be made about what to include or what to exclude. And that the decisions that you make can potentially reveal a lot about how you interacted with the text, what you got from it. This one on the right is especially true because that's it's a subject index. This one on the left is an index of place names mentioned in the text, which may be a little more exhaustive. But there's a lot going on here. Notice these check marks next to some of the place names. What do those mean? They could be places that the annotator has been to. They could be sections of the book that he thought were important or that he had finished reading or something. I don't know. We don't know. These are clearly ripe for further study. There's a lot going on here that could be of interest to historians of the book or of the history of reading. Annotations and marginalia are another way that early book owners often added value to their books, and another way that, that we can learn something about what they thought was important based on what they underlined, what they noted. But annotations and marginalia can also often help us in understanding the text itself. It can add value for us, too, as scholars, just like the annotators intended. This example is from an 18th century history of Florence, Italy. And this again, is something that we have featured downstairs that you might have seen. This page of the text, it's all in Italian. This page in the text talks about a carroccio, a type of four-wheeled cart that would be wheeled around the battlefield and would have a city's flag or battle standard on it. And on that cart, there'd be a little bell mounted called a martinella. And the bell would be used as the cart is wheeled around. The bell would be used to ring out military maneuvers, to ring out signals on the battlefield. This annotator not only has underlined important passages in the text, he's provided these handy little illustrations, an illustration of what this cart may have looked like, a kind of crude illustration, an illustration of what the bell would have looked like, and descriptions of how they worked and how they fit together. You can see that not only can we learn something about what he thought was important to highlight, this also then teaches us something. It's better for our purposes and for historians' purposes than just a blank copy, I would argue. We have other copies of this text, by the way, including one that's roughly contemporary with this. I think it was 50 years later or something, which in the grand scheme of things is contemporary. And it doesn't have any annotations or any underlining at all. Certainly doesn't have these annotations because, as I said, provenance evidence is unique. And I have to tell you, if I was trying to understand this text, I would greatly prefer to be working with a copy like this that has these study aids, if you will, these handy illustrations and underlining. And some of you may be shaking your head about that. You may say, no, I prefer clean books, unadulterated books. But know that I'm not alone in my preference. Studies have shown that students, when they are looking to buy textbooks, greatly prefer to buy books that other students in the past have owned and underlined and annotated. Why? Well, it's fairly obvious. They serve as a sort of a cheat sheet, a study aid. But more than that, they allow the new user of the book to dialogue, in a sense, with the user who's come before, the student of ages past. And I would argue that in cases like this, historians can do the same thing, too. They can learn a lot, potentially, from studying annotations in these books, many of which are centuries old. Now, I wish that we had more time to talk today, because I have so many more examples that I would love to show you. Examples, again, that are here, some that we don't have space for. And I could talk about this for hours. I mean, this is just fascinating stuff. But our time is limited, so I want to exit the slideshow here so that I can show you a little bit about how we are collecting this data here and what we're doing with this. Now, the ultimate goal of this provenance project is to make our database of provenance evidence publicly available, publicly accessible on the web, and eventually maybe add in some of the more interesting pieces of provenance evidence to the catalog records for the books, especially where they're lacking, like in that Doppelmayr inscription. To aid in the accessibility part, we are currently using Google Docs and Google Drive to record and store our data. Now, we're not committed to Google. There are better options out there, and our final public iteration of this database may be hosted somewhere else in a different repository, but it works well enough for our purposes now. For one, it's easy to use. Most of you are probably already familiar with it. You may use Google Drive for your personal or professional life. It's also cheap. Free, actually, for our purposes. Our database is text-based. It's essentially a giant spreadsheet. And even if we had a robust record of every piece of provenance in the vault, which is 15,000 items, let's say, it still wouldn't really be that big of a file, at least not by today's standards. Of course, it's online. It's cloud-based. And although we do make backup copies locally every so often, it's handy to be able to view it and edit it from anywhere, from any computer. We use this online form, this Google form, to record the data. As you can see, we identify the book by local call number, for example. We indicate where in the book the provenance evidence is located, whether it's on the recto of the title page or on the front paste down, or on page 362, or wherever it is in the book. We classify the type of evidence it is. We note whether it's a book plate or a binder's ticket or whatever it may be. Now you'll notice that this list is not complete, and you'll notice, of course, that this is not a free text field like these other ones. This just allows you to select from a list of terms. This is not accidental. Many years ago, the RBMS, the Rare Book and Manuscript section of the ACRL, the Association of College and Research Libraries, put out this thesaurus of provenance evidence terms, this controlled vocabulary, if you will. It's not perfect and it's not complete, but by restricting ourselves to these terms, we can allow our database to be able to talk to essentially other databases that are out there. It gives us some standard that we can follow. We don't use every term on this list, by the way, but we also haven't added any. This list also, which is especially useful for us, this list is, these are terms which are approved for use in MARC records for describing provenance, too. So that's another reason to stick to these. Let's see, going back to this, once you classify the type, you can then transcribe the text here, or if the provenance evidence is non-textual or if it's particularly long, like in those indexes we saw just a moment ago, you can just do your best to describe it. And then you can add any other pertinent notes here at the bottom. You can try to date the evidence if it's not dated. You can describe whether writing is in pen or in pencil, for example, or what color of ink it is if it's in pen. Anything else that might be pertinent to note. One of the other things about these preset fields is that these are singular. Many pieces of provenance evidence may have multiple parts. Inscriptions, for example, are often dated. There's an entry for inscription, there's also an entry for date. So what do you do? Well, we would say classify the piece of evidence by what best represents what it is. So a dated inscription, I would say, is an inscription, an ownership inscription. And then you can just make a note, you can say, with the date or something in the field, just so that it's searchable still by date, and it'll still come up. When you're done with that, you then hit submit, and the evidence is dumped into this spreadsheet. This is a nice way to store the data, at least for us right now, for a few reasons. You'll notice, for example, that it records a timestamp, the date and time that this evidence, that each entry was added. It's also easy to manipulate, which I can show you, assuming that I'm still connected to the internet here. You can see if you go to view list, for example, you can easily sort by category, allowing you, for example, just to view, let's say, all of the shelf marks that we've documented. And that'll bring up a handy list. You can also view a summary of responses so far, and it'll break down the number of entries for each evidence type and what percentage that is of the total. So you can see from this data, for example, that shelf marks, like we just looked at, account for about 17% of the instances of provenance evidence that we've cataloged so far, whereas, let's say, book plates, all taken together, account for about 6%. There's one other thing I want to show you today. Last semester, I wrote up a handbook outlining basically the things that I've been talking about today. What provenance is, why it's important, what forms that provenance evidence takes in rare books, how to go about recording it using the form that we created, and following the rules that we've laid out. This guide is used by our student employees and our volunteers to teach them how to use the system and how to record rare book provenance. But I also still refer back to it myself, to be honest, because it has a few things in here, like, for example, this, if I can find it, this handy guide to reading Elizabethan handwriting from a 1920s guide to bibliography. You can see here, and this has come in handy a lot of times, it has different variations here, common variations of, this is the capital letters here used in Elizabethan handwriting. Here are the lowercase or minuscules. I refer back to that all the time, especially in those really difficult cases like we looked at earlier. The handbook also includes things, reprints of things like this list of common abbreviations in Latin inscriptions, which can be found in David Pearson's fantastic thick volume, Provenance Research. Let's see. This also includes, again, instructions on how to record provenance using the form that you saw. It includes a glossary of book terminology, the parts of a book where provenance evidence is most likely to be found, and how to correctly apply that terminology. And there's a diagram that I made there. This includes the partial RBMS controlled vocabulary for provenance terms with usage notes. And it includes other things, like here are the RBMS guidelines for using this terminology and MARC records. And here's some other tips for inputting that into a MARC record. It includes a practice exercise, so you can try your hand at this. There are the answers, don't look at those. And of course, other resources that are useful for provenance. So the system is far from perfect. I'll be the first to admit that. But it's been working well enough for us so far. The number of books we've looked at is small, relatively small, compared to the total number of old rare books in special collections. But I suspect it's fairly representative. The reasons for that are we've looked at a number of different genres from a number of different places. It represents a fairly large range of dates. So I would be surprised if the final numbers, those statistics I showed you earlier, differed too much the more data we have. But that's the crux of it. We just need more data. That's the thing that we need the most of. This rare book provenance project, in many ways, is still in its infancy, and there's just a lot of work that still needs to be done. So with that in mind, I want to end this talk today with an appeal, a call for help, if you will. As I said, what we really need is more data. The way we get more data is more time and more people doing this provenance research. I'm only here part-time, for example. I come in 8 hours a week, which, let me tell you, is not enough time to do this really well. What Special Collections really needs in the long term is a full-time, dedicated rare book librarian, somebody who can become intimately familiar with the collection, somebody who can learn what we really have, because in many cases, as I showed you, we don't really know what we have, not in this sense. We also need volunteers. If this sounds like something you'd be interested in doing, looking at these old books, transcribing this provenance evidence, let us know. Talk to us today after the Q&A session. Drop by Special Collections. I'll put up my email address somewhere. I was going to write it on the whiteboard. Maybe I'll do that when I'm done here. You can email me if you don't want to talk today. We could especially use volunteers who have some reading knowledge of Latin, classical Greek, French, German, or Italian, any of those. My language skills are okay. I can get by, especially if it's Latin or Greek. But as you saw, some of those marginal notes and annotations are in German, are in Italian. And if you can read any of those languages to any proficiency, we can put you to work right away transcribing some of those, because those are interesting, potentially, but they're difficult to get through. But any help is useful. We'll take any volunteers. Our goal is, just like I've said, to build as robust a database of provenance as we can, not just to help scholars and historians, but also just to make Special Collections here at MSU the best that it can possibly be. So that's basically it. That's the talk. Thank you for stopping by and listening today. If you want, I'll answer some questions now, and then you can come up and look at some of these books, and we'll hang around, and I can tell you a little more about them. Yeah, thank you.
Mr. Swallow.
Thank you.
Mr. Swallow, the Habitation Heaven Guide, what was that text?
That text was a book on occult philosophy. A book on occult philosophy. Yeah, it was interesting. He writes his name a few other places in the book, and he's written a few other marginal notes in that book. Bizarre things. He counts from 1 to 9. He writes out the numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, a few places in the text for no reason that I can tell. The text is in English, and you can look at the text that it's next to, and I can't see any connection, but I don't know what sort of mystical significance his notes have.
What cults does he look at?
I'm not sure. It's an old book. It's a 16th or late 16th century or early 17th century work, I believe. And it's just about occult philosophy, anything that's not predominant Christianity, I would assume. They talk a lot about Judaism. They have, which is, you know, occult practices back then, apparently. They have a lot of tables in that book about mystical alphabets, and they explore the significance of various astrological signs and things, and also the mystical significance of letters of the Hebrew alphabet.
Do you
for example. And there's more in there. I'm not intimately familiar with it. But any other questions?
Well, if you find evidence of entries in different pages, do you make multiple entries in your database or just write down these numbers?
Yeah, it depends. It depends. If it's something that is just throughout the book or is on a lot of pages, I might just make a note saying, marginalia throughout or something like that, and then describe, how old it looks, whether it's pen or not, that sort of thing, whether it all looks like it's from the same hand. Many times we have books, of course, that have passed through many different owners, and some have marginal inscriptions and other things from four or five different hands. So I would note those separately, or again, if it's just throughout the book, I might say in four or five different hands. Yeah, it really depends, though. If it's just on a couple of pages and it's looks more interesting than just marginal notes, I might even transcribe each instance separately. But it depends. No other questions?
Yeah. Peter, are you just working from the oldest to the newest?
Well, right.
Or are you just dealing with things in the vault?
Right now, we are just dealing with things in the vault. We're basically going book by book. I don't know how fruitful that's really going to be. These older books are the most interesting and often have the most in them. There are exceptions like the Great Gatsby inscription, which is a modern book, 20th century book, and is very interesting. But often these older books, because they've been around for longer and they've had more owners, and also just because owners in the past often annotated their books more and wrote in their books more, I think those are often more interesting examples. So we may change gears. We may start going from earliest to latest or something like that. But right now, we've just been going through just call number by call number, basically, in the vault. Any other questions? Yeah?
If other libraries are going to this level of
There are a lot of blogs out there. There's actually one of the reasons that I think Peter wanted to do this is because there's been a lot of provenance projects at other universities that have a lot of visibility because of social media, because of the web. University of Pennsylvania, for example, has a fantastic blog, a Flickr account, actually. They have a blog, too, but they have a Flickr account. They post tens of thousands of images. Every book plate, basically, they find every inscription. They'll photograph it. They'll post it up on the Flickr. And so the Penn Provenance Project generates a lot of data, a lot of images, and presumably they have a fairly robust system for recording it there as well. I don't know the details of their system, but they've done a lot of work. A lot of other rare book libraries have been cataloging provenance for a long time. Harvard, Princeton, places like that have been doing this for a long time. Oxford. And I'm sure they've adapted to the web as well. Princeton has a blog, sort of like ours, where they talk about the same sort of thing, the interesting things they find in books, inscriptions, and things. The RBMS put out that controlled vocabulary of provenance terms 30 years ago now, I think. But people have known that recording provenance is important, and having a systematized way of doing it is important. But there was a study done, a survey, I think, that went out to rare book and special collections libraries in the 90s, in the mid-90s. It was like 15 years later or something, after this system had already been around for a while. And a third only of the responding institutions had any sort of provenance file at all, no matter how robust it was. They just, two-thirds of them didn't even record provenance at all. And that's probably, that number has gone up, the number of institutions that do, has probably gone up in the last 20 years, 15 years, but it's still probably not the majority of institutions. I don't have current figures, but a lot of the older, more established ones do, but a surprising number don't. So we are just trying to get in with the good crowd here. We're trying to jump ahead of this a little bit and become one of the more one of the more robust databases out there. That's the dream, anyway. We'll see. I don't know. Any other questions? Yeah?
If we were interested in working on books that fall within our subject area,
sure.
Expertise, would that?
Yeah, absolutely. That would be good. Yeah, that would probably that would be better, I would think, than just looking at any old books, especially if the annotations relate to the text in some way. If you have some subject area expertise, you'd probably be able to make more sense of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, we could definitely set you up with something like that. What's your field?
I have the Jewish and Muslim studies.
Okay, yeah, we have a lot of those. We have a lot of those. So yeah, we could do something. Talk to us after, or stop by Special Collections sometime. Anything else? Any other questions? Okay, well, thank you for coming, everybody.